William reminded himself, and he was plainly educated, for he made a decent fist of writing. What could have caused the odd Scottish Indian to take such an interest in him, though? Bemused, he reached for the smaller bundle and untied the string. Unwrapped, the contents proved to be the claw of a large bear, pierced and strung on a leather thong. It was old, the edges were worn, and the knot in the leather had hardened so far that it would plainly never be untied again. He stroked the claw with a thumb, tested the point. Well, the bear spirit had stood him in good stead so far. Smiling to himself, he put the thong over his head, leaving the claw to hang outside his shirt. Rachel Hunter stared at it, her face unreadable. "You read my letter, Miss Hunter," William said reprovingly. "Very naughty of you." The flush rose higher in her cheeks, but she met his eye with a directness he was unaccustomed to find in a woman, with a marked exception of his paternal grandmother. "Thy speech is far superior to thy clothes, friend William, even were they new. And while thee has been in thy right mind for some days now, thee has not chosen to say what brought thee to the Great Dismal. It is not a place frequented by gentlemen."
"Oh, indeed it is, Miss Hunter. Many gentlemen of my acquaintance go there for the hunting, which is unexcelled. But naturally one does not hunt wild boar or catamounts in one's best linen."
"Neither does one go hunting armed only with a frying pan, friend William," she riposted. "And if thee is a gentleman in truth, where is thy home, pray?" He fumbled for an instant, unable to recall at once his alter ego's particulars, and seized instead on the first city to come to his mind.
Savannah, in the Carolinas," he added helpfully. "I know where it is," she snapped, "and have heard men speak who come from there. Thee doesn't." "Are you calling me a liar?" he said, amazed.
"I am."
"Oh."
They sat gazing at each other in the half-light of the gathering storm, each calculating. For an instant, he had the illusion that he was playing chess with his grandmother, Benedicta. "I am sorry for reading thy letter," she said abruptly. "It was not vulgar curiosity, I assure thee."
"What then?"
He smiled a little to indicate that he bore no animus for her trespass. She didn't smile back, but looked at him narrowly, not in suspicion, but as though gauging him in some way. At last she sighed, though, and her shoulders slumped. "I wish to know a little of thee, and of thy character. The companions who brought thee to us seem dangerous men. And thy cousin? If thee is one like them, then..." Her teeth fixed briefly in her upper lip, but she shook her head as though to herself, and continued more firmly. "We must leave here within a few days, my brother and myself. Thee told Denny that thee travels north. I wish that we may travel with thee, at least for a time."
Whatever he'd been expecting, it wasn't that. He blinked and said the first thing that came to his mind.
"Leave here? Why? The neighbours?"
She looked surprised at that. "What?"
"I beg your pardon, ma'am. Your brother seemed to indicate that relations between your family and those who dwell nearby were somewhat strained."
"Oh."
One corner of her mouth tucked back. He couldn't tell if this betokened distress or amusement, but rather thought it was the latter.
"I see,"
she said,
and drummed her fingers thoughtfully on the table.
"Yes, that's true, though it was not what I... Well, and yet it has to do with the matter. I see I must tell thee everything, then. What does thee know about the Society of Friends?"
He knew only one family of Quakers, the Unwins. Mr. Unwin was a wealthy merchant who knew his father, and he had met the two daughters at a musicale once. But the conversation had not touched upon philosophy or religion.
"They You dislike conflict, I believe, he answered cautiously.
That surprisingly made her laugh, and he felt pleasure at having removed the tiny furrow between her brows, if only temporarily.
Violence, she corrected. We thrive upon conflict, if it be verbal. And given the form of our worship, Denny says thee is not a papist after all. Yet I venture to suppose that thee have never attended a Quaker meeting.
The opportunity has not so far occurred, no.
I thought not. Well, then,
she eyed him consideringly.
We have preachers who will come to speak at meeting, but anyone may speak at meeting upon any subject, if the Spirit moves him or her to do so.
Her? Women speak in public, too?
She gave him a withering look.
I have a tongue just as thee does.
I'd noticed, he said,
and smiled at her.
Continue, please.
She leaned forward a little to do so, but was interrupted by the crash of a shutter swinging back against the house, this followed by a spatter of rain dashed hard across the window. Rachel sprang to her feet with a brief exclamation.
I must get the chickens in. Close the shutters, she ordered him, and dashed out.
Taken aback, but amused, he did so, moving slowly. Going upstairs to fasten the upper shutters made him dizzy again, and he paused on the threshold of the bedroom, holding the door jamb until his balance returned. There were two rooms upstairs, the bedroom at the front of the house, where they had put him, and a smaller room in the rear. The hunters now shared this room. There was a truckle bed, a washstand with a silver candlestick upon it, and little else, save a row of pegs upon which hung the doctor's spare shirt and breeches, a woolen shawl, and what must be Rachel Hunter's go-to-meeting gown, a sober-looking garment dyed with indigo. With rain and wind muffled by the shutters, the dim room seemed still now and peaceful, a harbour from the storm. His heart had slowed from the exertion of climbing the stair, and he stood for a moment enjoying the slightly illicit sense of trespass. No sound from below. Rachel must still be in pursuit of the chickens. There was something faintly odd about the room, and it took him only a moment to decide what it was. The shabbiness and sparsity of the hunter's personal possessions argued poverty. Yet these contrasted with the small signs of prosperity evident in the furnishings. The candlestick was silver, not plate or pewter, and the ewer and basin were not earthenware, but good china, painted with sprawling blue chrysanthemums. He lifted the skirt of the blue dress hanging on the peg, examining it curiously. Modesty was one thing, threadbareness was another. The hem was worn nearly white, the indigo faded so that the folds of the skirt showed a fan-shaped pattern of light and dark. The Mrs. Unwin had dressed quietly, but their clothes were of the highest quality. On sudden impulse, he brought the cloth to his face, breathing in. It smelt faintly still of indigo, and of grass and live things, and very perceptibly of a woman's body. The musk of it ran through him like the pleasure of good wine. The sound of the door closing below made him drop the dress as though it had burst into flame, and he made for the stairs, heart hammering. Rachel Hunter was shaking herself on the hearth, shedding drops of water from her apron, her cap wilted and soggy on her head. Not seeing him, she took this off, wrung it out with a mutter of impatience, and hung it on a nail hammered into the chimney breast. Her hair fell down her back, wet-tailed and shining, dark against the pale cloth of her jacket.
The chickens are all safe, I trust.
He spoke, because to watch her unawares with her hair down, the smell of her still vivid in his nose, seemed suddenly to be an unwarrantable intimacy. She turned round, eyes wary, but made no immediate move to cover her hair.
All but the one my brother calls the Great Whore of Babylon. No chicken possesses anything resembling intelligence, but that one is perverse beyond the usual.
perverse. Evidently she perceived that he was contemplating the possibilities inherent in this description and finding them entertaining, for she snorted through her nose and bent to open the blanket chest.
The creature is sitting 20 feet up in a pine tree in the midst of a rainstorm. Perverse.
She pulled out a linen towel and began to dry her hair with it. The sound of the rain altered suddenly, hail rattling like tossed gravel against the shutters.
"Mm-hmm," said Rachel with a dark look at the window. "I expect she will be knocked senseless by the hail and devoured by the first passing fox. And serve her right."
She resumed drying her hair.
"No great matter. I shall be pleased never to see any of those chickens again."
Seeing him still standing, she sat down, gesturing him to another stool.
"You did say that you and your brother proposed to leave this place and travel north," he reminded her, sitting down. "I collect the chickens will not make the journey with you."
"No, and the Lord be praised. They are already sold, along with the house."
Laying the crumpled towel aside, she groped in her pocket and withdrew a small comb carved from horn.
"I did say I would tell thee why."
"I believe we had reached the point of learning that the matter has something to do with your meeting."
She breathed deeply through her nose and nodded.
"I said that when a person is moved of the spirit, he speaks in meeting. Well, the spirit moved my brother. That is how we came to leave Philadelphia."
"A meeting might be formed," she explained, "wherever there were sufficient friends of like mind. But in addition to these small local meetings, there were larger bodies, the quarterly and yearly meetings, at which weighty matters of principle were discussed, and actions affecting Quakers in general were decided upon."
"Philadelphia Yearly Meeting is the largest and most influential," she said. "Thee is right. The friends eschew violence and seek either to avoid it or to end it. And in this question of rebellion, Philadelphia Yearly Meeting thought and prayed upon the matter and advised that the path of wisdom and peace plainly lay in reconciliation with the mother country."
"Indeed."
William was interested.
"So all of the Quakers in the colonies are now loyalists, do you mean?"
Her lips compressed for an instant.
"That is the advice of the yearly meeting. As I said, though, friends are led of the spirit, and one must do as one is led to do."
"And your brother was led to speak in favour of rebellion?"
William was amused, though wary.
Dr. Hunter seemed an unlikely firebrand.
She dipped her head, not quite a nod.
"In favour of independency," she corrected.
"Surely there is something lacking in the logic of that distinction,"
William observed, raising one brow.
"How might independency be achieved without the exercise of violence?"
"If thee thinks the Spirit of God is necessarily logical, thee knows him better than I do."
She ran a hand through the damp hair, flicking it over her shoulders with impatience. "Denny said that it was made clear to him that liberty, whether that of the individual or of countries, is a gift of God, and that it was laid upon him that he must join in the fight to gain and preserve it."
"So, we were put out of meeting," she ended abruptly.
It was dark in the room with the shutters closed, but he could see her face by the dim glow from the smothered hearth. That last statement had moved her strongly. Her mouth was pinched, and there was a brightness to her eyes that suggested she might weep, were she not determined not to.
"I collect this is a serious thing, to be put out of meeting,"
he asked cautiously. She nodded, looking away. She picked up the discarded damp towel, smoothed it slowly, and folded it, plainly choosing her words.
"I told thee that my mother died when I was born. My father died 3 years later, drowned in a flood. We were left with nothing, my brother and I, but the local meeting saw to it that we did not starve, that there was a roof, if one with holes, over our heads. There was a question in meeting how Denny might be prenticed. I know he feared that he must become a drover or a cobbler. He lacks somewhat to be a blacksmith,"
she added, smiling a little despite her seriousness. He would have done it, though, to keep me fed.
Luck had intervened, however. One of the friends had taken it upon himself to try to trace any relatives of the orphaned Hunter children, and after a number of letters to and fro, had discovered a distant cousin, originally from Scotland, but presently in London.
John Hunter, bless his name. He is a famous physician, he and his elder brother, who is accoucheur to the Queen herself.
Despite her egalitarian principles, Miss Hunter looked somewhat awed, and William nodded respectfully.
He inquired as to Denny's abilities, and hearing good report, made provision for Denny to remove to Philadelphia, to board there with a Quaker family, and to go to the new medical college. And then he went so far as to have Denny go to London, to study there with himself.
Very good luck indeed, William observed. But what about you?
Oh, I was taken in by a woman in the village, she said, with a quick casualness that didn't deceive him. But Denzel came back, and so, of course, I came to keep his house until he might wed.
She was pleating the towel between her fingers, looking down into her lap. There were small lights in her hair where the fire caught it, a hint of bronze in the dark brown locks.
The woman, she was a goodly woman. She took care I should learn to keep a house, to cook, to sew, that I should know what is needful for a woman to know.
She glanced at him with that odd directness, her face sober.
I think thee cannot understand, she said, what it means to be put out of meeting.
Something like being drummed out of one's regiment, I expect. Disgraceful and distressing.
Her eyes narrowed for a moment, but he had spoken seriously, and she saw that.
A friend's meeting is not only a fellowship of worship, it is a community of mind, of heart. A larger family, in a way.
And for a young woman, bereft of her own family.
And to be put out, then. Yes, I see, he said quietly.
There was a brief silence in the room then, broken only by the sound of the rain. He thought he heard a rooster crow somewhere far off.
Thy mother is dead too, thee said.
Rachel looked at him, dark eyes soft.
Does thy father live?
He shook his head.
You will think I am exceedingly dramatic, he said. It is the truth, though. My father also died upon the day of my birth.
She blinked at that.
Truly.
He was a good 50 years my mother's senior. When he heard that she was dead in childbirth, he suffered an apoplexy and died upon the spot.
He was annoyed. He seldom stuttered any more. She hadn't noticed, though.
So thee is orphan too. I am sorry for thee, she said quietly.
He shrugged, feeling awkward.
Well, I knew neither of my parents. And in fact, I did have parents. My mother's sister became my mother in all respects. She's dead now too. And her husband, I have always thought of him as my father, though he is not related to me by blood.
It occurred to him that he was treading on dangerous ground here, talking too much about himself. He cleared his throat and endeavoured to guide the conversation back to less personal matters.
Your brother, how does he propose to implement this revelation of his?
She sighed. This house, it belonged to a cousin of our mother's. He was a widower and childless. He willed the house to Denzel, though when he heard about our being put out of meeting, he wrote to say that he meant to alter his will. By happenstance, though, he caught a bad ague and died before he could do so. But all his neighbours knew, of course, about Denny, which is why...
I see.
It seemed to William that while God might not be logical, he seemed to be taking a most particular interest in Denzel Hunter. He thought it might not be mannerly to say so, though, and inquired in a different direction.
You said the house was sold. So your brother...
He has gone into the town to the courthouse, to sign the papers for the sale of the house and make arrangements for the goats, pigs, and chickens. As soon as that is done, we will leave.
She swallowed visibly.
Denny means to join the Continental Army as a surgeon.
And you will go with him, as a camp follower?
William spoke with some disapproval. Many soldiers' wives, or concubines, did follow the drum, essentially joining the army with their husbands. He hadn't seen much of camp followers yet himself, as there had been none on the Long Island campaign. But he'd heard his father speak of such women now and then, mostly with pity. It wasn't a life for a woman of refinement.
She lifted her chin, hearing his disapproval. Certainly.
A long wooden pin lay on the table. She must have taken it from her hair when she removed her cap. Now she twisted her damp hair up into a knot and stabbed the pin decisively through it.
So, she said, will he travel with us? Only so far as he may be comfortable in doing so, she added quickly.
He had been turning the notion over in the back of his mind all the while they had talked. Plainly, such an arrangement would have advantages for the hunters. A large group was always safer. And it was apparent to William that, his revelation notwithstanding, the doctor was not a natural warrior. It would, he thought, have some advantage to himself as well. The hunters knew something of the immediate countryside, which he did not. And a man travelling in a group, particularly a group including a woman, was much less noticeable and much less suspicious than one alone. It dawned on him suddenly that if Hunter meant to join the Continental Army, there might be excellent opportunity of getting close enough to Washington's forces to gain valuable intelligence of them, something that would go a long way toward compensating for the loss of his book of contacts.
Yes, certainly, he said,
and smiled at Miss Hunter. An admirable suggestion. A flash of lightning stabbed suddenly through the slits of the shutters, and a clap of thunder crashed overhead almost simultaneously. Both of them started violently at the noise. William swallowed, feeling his ears still ring. The sharp scent of lightning burned the air.
I do hope, he said, that that was a sign of approval.
She didn't laugh. Chapter 40. The Blessing of Bride and of Michael. The Mohawk knew him as Tyendanegea, Two Wagers. To the English, he was Joseph Brant. Ian had heard much of the man when he dwelt among the Mohawk, by both his names, and had wondered more than once just how well Tyendanegea managed the treacherous ground between two worlds.
Was it like the bridge, he thought suddenly, the slender bridge that lay between this world and the next, the air around it assailed by flying heads with rending teeth? Sometime he would like to sit by a fire with Joseph Brant and ask him. He was going to Brant's house now, but not to speak with Brant. Glutton had told him that Sun Elk had left Snake Town to join Brant and that his wife had gone with him.
They are in Unadilla, Glutton had said. Probably still there.
Tyendanegea fights with the English, you know. He's talking to the loyalists up there, trying to get them to join him and his men. He calls them Brant's volunteers.
He spoke casually.
Glutton wasn't interested in politics, though he would fight now and then when the spirit moved him.
Does he?
Ian said just as casually.
Well, then.
He had no particular idea where Unadilla was, save that it was in the colony of New York, but that was no great difficulty. He set out next day at dawn, heading north. He had no company save the dog, and his thoughts, most of the time. At one point, though, he came to a summer camp of Mohawk and was welcomed there. He sat with the men, talking. After a time, a young woman brought him a bowl of stew and he ate it, barely noticing what was in it, though his belly seemed grateful for the warmth and stopped clenching itself. He couldn't say what drew his eye, but he looked up from the men's talk to see the young woman who had brought him the stew sitting in the shadow just outside the fire,
looking at him. She smiled, very slightly. He chewed more slowly, the taste of the stew suddenly a savour in his mouth. Bear meat rich with fat, corn and beans spiced with onions and garlic. Delicious. She tilted her head to one side, one dark brow rose, elegant. Then she rose too, as though lifted by her question. Ian set down his bowl and belched politely, then got up and went outside, paying no attention to the knowing looks of the men with whom he'd been eating. She was waiting, a pale blur in the shadow of a birch. They talked. He felt his mouth form words, felt the tickle of her speech in his ears, but wasn't really aware of what they said. He held the glow of his anger like a live coal in the palm of his hand, an ember smoking in his heart. He had no thought of her as water to his scorching, nor did he think to kindle her. There were flames behind his eyes, and he was mindless as fire is, devouring where there was fuel, dying where there was not. He kissed her. She smelled of food, worked skins, and sun-warmed earth. No hint of wood, no tinge of blood. She was tall. He felt her breasts soft and pushing, dropped his hands to the curve of her hips. She moved against him, solid, willing, drew back, letting cool air touch his skin where she had been, and took him by the hand to lead him to her longhouse. No one glanced at them as she took him into her bed, and, in the half-dark warmth, turned to him, naked. He thought it would be better if he couldn't see her face. Anonymous, quick, some pleasure for her, perhaps. Surcease for him. For the few moments when he lost himself, at least. But in the dark, she was Emily, and he fled from her bed in shame and anger, leaving astonishment behind. For the next 12 days he walked, the dog by his side, and spoke to no one.
Tyandinega's house stood by itself, in large grounds, but near enough the village to be still part of it.
The village was much as any other, save that many of the houses had 2 or 3 grindstones by the step. Each woman ground meal for her family, rather than take it to a mill. There were dogs in the street, dozing in the shadows of wagons and walls. Everyone sat up, startled, when Rollo came within scenting distance. A few growled or barked, but none offered to fight. The men were another matter. There were several men leaning on a fence, watching another with a horse in a field. All of them cast glances at him, half curious, half wary. He didn't know most of them. One of them, though, was a man named Eats Turtles, whom he had known in Snake Town. Another was Sun Elk. Sun Elk blinked at him, startled as any of the dogs, and then stepped out into the road to face him.
"What are you doing here?"
He considered for a split second telling the truth, but it wasn't a truth that could be told quickly, if at all, and certainly not before strangers.
"None of your business," he answered calmly.
Sun Elk had spoken to him in Mohawk, and he'd answered in the same language. He saw eyebrows rise, and Turtle made to greet him, clearly hoping to avert whatever storm was in the offing by making it clear that Ian was Cayenne Kahaka himself. He returned Turtle's greeting, and the others drew back, a little puzzled and interested, but not hostile. Sun Elk, on the other hand... Well, Ian hadn't expected the man to fall on his neck, after all. He'd hoped, insofar as he'd thought about Sun Elk, which was very little, that he'd be elsewhere. But here he was, and Ian smiled wryly to himself, thinking of old Granny Wilson, who had once described her son-in-law Hiram as looking like he wouldn't give the road to a bear. It was an apt description. And Sun Elk's disposition was not improved either by Ian's reply, nor by the subsequent smile.
"What do you want?" Sun Elk demanded.
"Nothing that's yours," Ian replied,
as mildly as possible. Sun Elk's eyes narrowed, but before he could say anything else, Turtle intervened, inviting Ian to come into his house to eat, to drink. He should. It wasn't polite to refuse. And he could ask later, privately, where Emily was. But the need that had brought him over 300 miles of wilderness acknowledged no requirements of civility. Neither would it brook delay. Besides, he reflected, readying himself, he'd known it would come to this. No point in putting it off.
"I wish to speak with her who was once my wife," he said.
"Where is she?"
Several of the men blinked at that, interested or taken back. But he saw Turtle's eyes flick toward the gates of the large house at the end of the road. Sun Elk, to his credit, merely drew himself up and planted himself more solidly in the road, ready to defy 2 bears if necessary. Rollo didn't care for this, and lifted his lip in a growl that made 1 or 2 of the men step back sharply. Sun Elk, who had better reason than most of them to know just what Rollo was capable of, didn't move an inch.
"Do you mean to set your demon on me?" he asked. "Of course not. Hasaku," he said quietly to Rollo.
The dog stood his ground for a moment longer, just long enough to indicate that it was his idea, and then turned aside and lay down, though he kept up a low grumble like distant thunder.
"I have not come to take her from you," Ian said to Sun Elk.
He'd meant to be conciliatory, but he hadn't really expected it to work, and it didn't.
"You think you could?"
"If I dinna want to, does it matter?"
Ian said testily, lapsing into English.
"She wouldn't go with you even if you killed me."
"How many times must I say that I dinna want to take her away from you?"
Sun Elk stared at him for a minute, his eyes quite black.
"Often enough for your face to say the same thing," he whispered,
and clenched his fists. An interested murmur rose from the other men, but there was an intangible drawing away. They wouldn't interfere in a fight over a woman. That was a blessing, Ian thought vaguely, watching Sun Elk's hands. The man was right-handed, he remembered that. There was a knife on his belt, but his hand wasn't hovering near it. Ian spread his own hands peaceably.
"I wish only to talk with her."
"Why?"
Sun Elk barked. He was close enough for Ian to feel the spray of spittle on his face, but he didn't wipe it away. He didn't back away either, and dropped his hands.
"That's between me and her," he said quietly. "I dare say she'll tell you later."
The thought of it gave him a pang. The statement didn't seem to reassure Sun Elk, who, without warning, hit him in the nose. The crunch echoed through his upper teeth, and Sun Elk's other fist struck him a glancing blow on the cheekbone. He shook his head to clear it, saw the blur of movement through watering eyes, and, more by good fortune than intent, kicked Sun Elk solidly in the crotch. He stood breathing heavily, dripping blood on the roadway. 6 pairs of eyes went from him to Sun Elk, curled in the dust and making small, urgent noises. Rollo got up, walked over to the fallen man, and smelled him with interest. All the eyes came back to Ian. He made a small motion of the hand that brought Rollo to heel, and walked up the road toward Brant's house, 6 pairs of eyes fixed on his back. When the door opened, the young white woman who stood there gaped at him, eyes round as pennies. He'd been in the act of wiping his bloody nose with his shirt tail. He completed this action and inclined his head civilly.
"Will you be so good as to ask Wakyo Teye Snonsa if she will be pleased to speak with Ian Murray?"
The young woman blinked twice. Then she nodded and swung the door to, pausing with it halfway shut, in order to look at him once more and assure herself that she'd really seen him. Feeling strange, he stepped down into the garden. It was a formal English garden, with rose bushes and lavender and stone-flagged paths. The smell of it reminded him of Auntie Claire, and he wondered briefly
whether Tyandonega had brought back an English gardener from London.
There were two women at work in the garden some distance away. One was a white woman by the colour of the hair beneath her cap, and in her middle years by the stoop of her shoulders. Perhaps Brandt's wife, he wondered. Was the young woman who had answered the door their daughter? The other woman was Indian, with her hair in a plait down her back, but streaked with white. Neither one turned to look at him. When he heard the click of the door latch behind him, he waited a moment before turning around, steeling himself against the disappointment of being told that she wasn't here, or worse, that she had refused to see him. But she was there. Emily, small and straight, with her breasts showing round in the neck of a blue calico gown, her long hair bound up behind but uncovered, and her face fearful but eager. Her eyes lit with joy at the sight of him, and she took a step toward him. He would have crushed her to him had she come to him, made any gesture inviting it. And what then? He wondered dimly. But it didn't matter. After that first impulsive movement toward him, she stopped and stood, her hands fluttering for an instant as though they would shape the air between them, but then folding tight before her, hidden in the folds of her skirt.
Wolf's brother, she said softly in Mohawk. My heart is warm to see you.
Mine too, he said in the same language.
Have you come to speak with Tyandonega? She asked, tilting her head back toward the house.
Perhaps later. Neither of them mentioned his nose, though from all the throbbing it was likely twice its normal size, and there was blood all down the front of his shirt. He glanced around. There was a path that led away from the house, and he nodded at that.
Will you walk with me?
She hesitated for a moment. The flame in her eyes had not gone out, but it burned lower now. There were other things there, caution, mild distress, and what he thought was pride. He was surprised that he should see them so clearly. It was as though she were made of glass.
The children, she blurted, half turning toward the house.
It doesn't matter, he said. I only...
A dribble of blood from one nostril stopped him, and he paused to wipe the back of his hand across his upper lip. He took the two steps necessary to bring them within touching distance, though he was careful not to touch her.
I wish to say to you that I am sorry, he said formally in Mohawk, that I could not give you children, and I am glad you have them.
A lovely warm flush rose in her cheeks, and he saw the pride in her overcome the distress.
May I see them? He asked, surprising himself as much as her.
She wavered for an instant, but then turned and went into the house. He sat on a stone wall waiting, and she returned a few moments later with a small boy, maybe 5 years old, and a girl of three or so in short plaits, who looked gravely at him and sucked her fist. Blood had run down the back of his throat. It felt raw and tasted of iron. Now and then on his journey, he'd gone carefully over the explanation Auntie Claire had given him. Not with any notion of telling it to Emily. It could mean nothing to her. He barely understood it himself. Only, maybe as some shield against this moment, seeing her with the children he couldn't give her.
Call it fate,
Claire had said, looking at him with a hawk's eye, the one that sees from far above, so far above, maybe, that what seems mercilessness is truly compassion. Or call it bad luck, but it wasn't your fault, or hers.
Come here,
he said in Mohawk, putting out a hand to the little boy. The boy glanced at his mother, but then came to him, looking up in curiosity to his face.
I see you in his face, he said softly to her, speaking English. And in his hands, he added in Mohawk, taking the child's hands, so amazingly small, in his own.
It was true. The boy had her hands, fine-boned and supple. They curled up like sleeping mice in his palms. Then the fingers sprang out like spider's legs, and the boy giggled. He laughed too, closing his own hand swiftly on the boy's, like a bear gulping a pair of trout, making the child shriek. Then let go.
"Are you happy?" he asked her.
"Yes," she said softly. She looked down, not meeting his eyes, and he knew it was because she would answer honestly, but did not wish to see if her answer hurt him. He put a hand under her chin. Her skin was so soft, and lifted her face to him.
"Are you happy?"
he asked again, and smiled a little as he said it. "Yes," she said again, but then gave a small sigh, and her own hand touched his face at last, light as a moth's wing. "But sometimes I miss you, Ian." There was nothing wrong with her accent, but his Scots name sounded impossibly exotic on her tongue. It always had. He felt a lump in his throat, but kept the faint smile on his face.
"I see your dinner asks me whether I'm happy," he said,
and could have kicked himself. She gave him a quick look, direct as a knife point. "I have eyes," she said, very simply. There was a silence between them. He looked away, but could feel her there, breathing, ripe, soft. He felt her softening further, opening. She had been wise not to go into the garden with him. Here, with her son playing in the dirt near her feet, it was safe. For her, at least. "Do you mean to stay?" she asked at last, and he shook his head.
"I'm going to Scotland," he said.
"You will take a wife among your own people." There was relief in that, but regret too.
"Are your people no longer my own?" he asked with a flash of fierceness. "They washed the white blood from my body in the river. You were there."
"I was there." She looked at him for a long time, searching his face. Likely enough that she would never see him again. Did she seek to remember him? Or was she looking for something in his features, he wondered. The latter. She turned abruptly, raising a hand to him to wait, and disappeared into the house. The little girl ran after her, not wanting to stay with the stranger. But the little boy lingered, interested. "Are you Wolf's brother?"
"I am, aye. And you?"
"They call me Digger." It was a child's sort of name, used for convenience until the person's real name should declare itself in some way. Ian nodded, and they remained a few minutes, looking each other over with interest, but with no sense of awkwardness between them. "She who is mother's mother to my mother," Digger said quite suddenly. "She talked about you. To me."
"She did," said Ian, startled.
That would be Tewaktunyon, a great woman, head of the Women's Council at Snake Town, and the person who had sent him away.
"Does Tewaktunyon still live?" he asked, curious.
"Oh, yes. She's older than the mountains," the little boy answered seriously. "She has only 2 teeth left, but she still eats."
Ian smiled at that.
"Good. What did she say to you of me?"
The boy screwed up his face, recollecting the words. "She said, I was the child of your spirit, but I should not say so to my father."
Ian felt the blow of that, harder than any the child's father had dealt him, and couldn't speak for a moment. "Aye, I dinna think you should say so either," he said, when words returned to him.
He repeated the sentiment in Mohawk, in case the boy might not have understood English. And the child nodded, tranquil. "Will I be with you sometime?" he asked, only vaguely interested in the answer. A lizard had come out onto the stone wall to bask, and his eyes were fixed on it. Ian forced his own words to be casual.
"If I live."
The boy's eyes were narrowed, watching the lizard, and the tiny right hand twitched just a little. The distance was too far, though. He knew it, and glanced at Ian, who was closer. Ian cut his eyes at the lizard without moving, then looked back at the boy, and agreement sprang up between them.
Don't move,
his eyes warned, and the boy seemed to cease breathing. It didn't do to think in such situations. Without pausing to draw breath, he snatched, and the lizard was in his hand, astonished and thrashing. The little boy chortled and hopped up and down, clapping his hands with glee, then held them out for the lizard, which he received with the greatest concentration, folding his hands about it so that it might not escape.
"And what will you do with him?"
Ian asked, smiling. The boy held the lizard up to his face, peering at it intently, and his brow furrowed in thought.
"I will name him," he said at last. "Then he will be mine, and bless me when I see him again."
He brought the lizard up, eyeball to eyeball, and each stared unblinking at the other.
"Your name is Bob,"
the boy declared at last in English, and with great ceremony set the lizard on the ground. Bob leapt from his hands and disappeared under a log.
"A very good name," Ian said gravely.
His bruised ribs hurt with the need not to laugh, but the urge vanished in the next moment as the distant door opened and Emily came out, a bundle in her arms. She came up to him and presented him with a child, swaddled and bound to a cradle board, in much the same way he had presented the lizard to Digger.
"This is my second daughter," she said, shyly proud. "Will you choose her name?"
He was moved and touched Emily's hand very lightly before taking the cradle board onto his knee and looking searchingly into the tiny face. She couldn't have given him greater honour, this permanent mark of the feeling she had once held for him, still might hold for him. But as he looked at the little girl, she regarded him with round, serious eyes, taking in this new manifestation of her personal landscape, a conviction took root in him. He didn't question it. It was simply there, and undeniable.
"Thank you," he said,
and smiled at Emily with great affection. He laid his hand, huge and rough with callus and the nicks of living, on the tiny, perfect, soft-haired head.
"I will bless all your children with the blessings of Bride and of Michael."
He lifted his hand then, and reaching out, drew Digger to him.
"But this one is mine to name."
Her face went quite blank with astonishment, and she looked quickly from him to her son and back. She swallowed visibly, unsure. But it didn't matter. He was sure.
"Your name is Swiftest of Lizards," he said in Mohawk.
The Swiftest of Lizards thought for a minute, then nodded, pleased, and with a laugh of pure delight, darted away. Chapter 41. Shelter from the Storm. Not for the first time, William was startled to realise the breadth of his father's acquaintance. In casual conversation as they rode, he had mentioned to Denzel Hunter that his father had once known a Dr. John Hunter. In fact, the association involving an electric eel, an impromptu duel, and the implications of body snatching was part of the situation that had sent Lord John to Canada and to the Plains of Abraham. Might this John Hunter perhaps be the beneficent relative that Miss Rachel had mentioned? Denny Hunter had brightened at once.
"How remarkable! Yes, it must be the same, particularly since he mentions body snatching in connection with him."
He coughed, seeming a little embarrassed.
"It was a most educational association," Hunter said, "though a disturbing one, upon occasion."
He glanced back at his sister, but Rachel was well behind them, her mule ambling, and Rachel herself half asleep in the saddle, her head nodding like a sunflower's.
"The understands, friend William," Hunter said, lowering his voice, "that in order to become skilled in the arts of surgery, it is necessary to learn how the human body is constructed and to understand its workings.
Only so much can be learned from texts. And the texts upon which most medical men rely are, well, to be blunt about it, they are wrong.
Oh, yes.
William was only half attending to the conversation. The other half of his mind was evenly divided among his assessment of the road, a hope that they might reach somewhere habitable in time to procure supper, and an appreciation of the slenderness of Rachel Hunter's neck on the rare occasions when she rode in front of him. He wanted to turn round and look at her again, but couldn't do it so soon in all decency.
Another few minutes.
Galen and Aesculapius. The common conception is, and has been for a very long time, that the ancient Greeks had written down everything known regarding the human body. There was no need to doubt these texts or to create mystery where there was none.
William grunted.
You should hear my uncle go on about ancient military texts. He's all for Caesar, who he says was a very decent general. But he takes leave to doubt that Herodotus ever saw a battlefield.
Hunter glanced at him in surprised interest.
Exactly what John Hunter said, in different terms, regarding Avicenna. The man's never seen a pregnant uterus in his life.
He smacked a fist upon his pommel to emphasize the point, and his horse jerked its head, startled.
Whoa, whoa,
said Hunter, alarmed, sawing on the reins in a way calculated to have the horse rearing and pawing in moments. William leaned over and neatly took the reins out of Denzel's hands, giving them slack. He was rather glad of the brief distraction, as it kept Hunter from discoursing further about uteruses.
William wasn't at all sure what a uterus was, but if it got pregnant, it must have to do with a woman's privates, and that was not something he wished to discuss within the hearing of Miss Hunter.
But you said your association with Dr. John Hunter was disturbing, he said, handing Hunter back the reins and hastening to change the subject before the doctor could think of something more embarrassing to mention.
Why was that?
Well, we, his students, learned the mysteries of the human body from the human body.
William felt a slight clench of the belly.
Dissection, you mean?
Yes.
Hunter glanced at him, concerned.
It is a distasteful prospect, I know. And yet to see the marvellous fashion in which God has ordered things, the intricacies of a kidney, the amazing interior of a lung. William, I cannot tell thee what revelation it is.
Well, yes, I see it must be, William said guardedly.
Now he could reasonably glance back and did so. Rachel had straightened, stretching her back, head tilted so that her straw hat fell back, the sun on her face, and he smiled.
Where did you get the bodies to dissect?
Dr. Hunter sighed.
That was the disturbing aspect. Many were paupers from the workhouse or the street, and their deaths were most pitiable. But many were the bodies of executed criminals. And while I must be pleased that some good came of their deaths, I could not but be appalled at those deaths.
Why? William asked, interested.
Why?
Hunter blinked at him behind his spectacles, but then shook his head as though shaking off flies.
But I forget, thee is not one of us. Your pardon. We do not condone violence, friend William, and surely not killing.
Not even criminals? Murderers?
Denzel's lips compressed, and he looked unhappy, but shook his head.
No. Let them be imprisoned or put to some useful labour. But for the state to commit murder in its turn is a dreadful violation of God's commandment. It implicates all of us in the commission of this sin. Does thee not see?
I see that the state, as you call it, has responsibility for its subjects, William said, rather nettled. You expect constables and judges to see that you and your property are secure, don't you? If the state has that responsibility, surely it must have the means of carrying it out.
I do not contest that. Imprison criminals, if necessary, as I say. But the state has no right to kill people on my behalf.
Has it not? William said dryly. Have you any idea of the nature of some of the criminals who are executed? Of their crimes?
Has thee?
Hunter gave him a raised brow.
I have, yes. The governor of Newgate Prison is an acquaintance, another acquaintance, of my father's. I have sat at table with him and heard stories that would take the curl out of your wig, Dr. Hunter. If you wore one, he added.
Hunter responded to the jest with a fleeting smile.
Call me by my name, he said. Thee knows we do not hold by titles. And I admit the truth of what thee says. I have heard and seen more terrible things than you have likely heard at your father's table. But justice lies in God's hand. To do violence, to take a life, is to violate God's command and do grievous sin.
And if you are attacked, injured, you may not fight back, William demanded. You may not defend yourselves, your families.
We rely upon the goodness and mercy of God, Denzel said firmly. And if we are killed, then we die in the firm expectation of God's life and resurrection.
They rode in silence for a moment before William said conversationally,
Or you rely upon the willingness of someone else to commit violence for you.
Denzel drew a deep instinctive breath, but thought better of whatever he had meant to say. They rode in silence for some time, and when they spoke again, it was of birds. It was raining when they woke next day. Not a quick thundershower, here and gone, but a heavy, remorseless sort of rain that looked set to pour steadily all day. There was no point in staying where they were. The rocky overhang under which they had sheltered for the night lay directly exposed to the wind, and the rain had already dampened the firewood sufficiently as to cause their breakfast fire to yield much more smoke than heat. Still coughing intermittently, William and Denny loaded the pack mule while Rachel bound up a bundle of the least damp sticks in canvas. If they found shelter by nightfall, they might at least be able to start a fire to cook their supper, even if the rain continued. There was little conversation. Even had they been so inclined, the rain beat so heavily upon trees and ground and upon their hats that anything said had to be half shouted to be heard. In a state of sodden but dogged determination, they rode slowly north by northeast, Denny anxiously consulting his compass when they reached a crossroad.
What think thee, friend William?
Denny took off his spectacles and wiped them, to little effect, on the skirt of his coat.
Neither road runs precisely as we might wish, and friend Lockett didn't mention this crossroad in his instruction. That one,
he pointed at the road that crossed the one they were set upon,
appears to run north, while this one is due east. At the moment.
He glanced at William, his face oddly naked without his spectacles. A farmer named Lockett and his wife had been their last contact with humanity 3 days before. She had given them supper, sold them bread, eggs, and cheese, and her husband had set them on the road toward Albany, he said.
They should run across an indication of the Continental Army somewhere between here and there.
But he hadn't mentioned a crossroad. William gave the muddy ground a glance, but the crossroad itself lay in a low spot and was nothing more now than a small lake. No clues to traffic, but the road they were on seemed substantially wider than the smaller one crossing it.
This one,
he said firmly, and nudged his horse, squelching through the lake to the other side. Now it was late afternoon, and he was beginning to be worried about his decision. Had they been upon the right road, they should, said Mr. Lockett, encounter a small hamlet called Johnson's Ford by the end of the day. Of course, the rain had slowed them, he told himself, and while the countryside looked as vacant and writhingly verdant as ever, villages and farmsteads did pop up as suddenly as mushrooms after a heavy rain, in which case they might encounter Johnson's Ford at any moment.
Maybe the place is dissolved.
Rachel leaned up from her saddle to call to him. Rachel had nearly dissolved herself, and he grinned, in spite of his worry. The rain had beaten the brim of her straw hat down, so that it hung limp as a duster around her head. She was obliged to lift the front of it in order to peer out, like a suspicious toad under a harrow. Her clothes were soaked through as well, and as she was wearing three layers of everything, she resembled nothing so much as a large, untidy bale of wet laundry, forked steaming from the kettle. Before he could reply to her, though, her brother sat up straight in his saddle, showering water in all directions, and pointed dramatically down the road.
"Look!"
William jerked his head round, assuming that their destination was in sight. It wasn't, but the road was no longer empty. A man was walking briskly toward them through the mud, a split burlap sack shielding his head and shoulders from the rain. In the current state of desolation, anything human was a sight to gladden the eye, and William spurred up a little to hail the fellow.
"Well met, young sir," said the man, peering up at William from his burlap refuge. "Where ye bound this dismal day?"
He lifted a lip in ingratiation, showing a broken dog tooth stained with tobacco.
"Johnson's Ford. Are we headed right?"
The man reared back, as though astonished.
"Johnson's Ford, you say?"
"I do, yes," William said, with a certain amount of testiness. He sympathised with the lack of company in rural parts and the subsequent impulse of the inhabitants to detain travellers as long as possible, but this was not the day for it.
"Where is it?"
The man shook his head back and forth in slow dismay.
"'Fraid you've missed your turn, sir. Ought to have gone left at the crossroads."
Rachel made a small, pitiable sound at this. The light was already failing, shadow beginning to pool round the horse's feet. It was several hours' ride back to the crossroad. They could not hope to reach it before nightfall, let alone make their way to Johnson's Ford. The man plainly realised this as well. He smiled happily at William, revealing a wide expanse of brown gum.
"If so be as you gentlemen help me cotch my cow and drive her home, the wife will be pleased to offer you supper and a bed."
There being no reasonable alternative, William accepted this suggestion with what grace he could, and leaving Rachel sheltering under a tree with the animals, he and Denny Hunter went to assist with the cow cotching. The cow in question, a raw-boned, shaggy beast with a wild eye, proved both elusive and obdurate, and it took the combined talents of all three men to capture it and drag it to the road. Soaked to the skin and thickly plastered with mud, the bedraggled party then followed Mr. Antioch Johnson, for so their host had introduced himself, through the gathering shades of night to a small ramshackle farmhouse. The rain was still pelting down, though, and any roof was welcome, leaky or not. Mrs. Johnson proved to be a ragged slattern of uncertain age, with even fewer teeth than her husband, and a sullen disposition. She glared at the dripping guests, and turned her back rudely upon them, but did produce wooden bowls of a vile, congealed stew, and there was fresh milk from the cow. William noticed that Rachel took but a single bite of the stew, turned pale, removed something from her mouth, and set down her spoon, after which she confined herself to the milk. He himself was much too hungry, either to taste the stew or care what was in it, and fortunately it was too dark to examine the contents of his bowl. Denny was making an effort to be sociable, though he was swaying with weariness, answering Mr. Johnson's unending questions about their origins, journey, destination, connection, news of the road and opinions, and news regarding the war. Rachel attempted a smile now and then, but her eyes kept passing uneasily around their surroundings, returning again and again to their hostess, who sat in the corner, her own eyes hooded, brooding over a fuming clay pipe that hung from a slack lower lip. Belly full and with dry stockings, William felt the labours of the day begin to catch up to him. There was a decent fire in the hearth, and the leaping flames lulled him into a sort of trance, the voices of Denny and Mr. Johnson fading into a pleasant murmur. He might have fallen asleep right there, had the rustle of Rachel rising to her feet to visit the privy not broken the trance, reminding him that he should check the horses and mules. He'd rubbed them dry as well as he could, and paid Mr. Johnson for hay, but there was no real barn to shelter them, only a crude roof of branches perched on spindly poles. He didn't want them standing all night in mud, should the shelter be flooded. It was still raining, but the air outside was clean and fresh, filled with the night scent of trees, grasses, and rushing water. After the fog indoors, William felt nearly light-headed with the fragrance. He ducked through the rain to the shelter, doing his best to keep the small torch he had brought alight, enjoying every breath. The torch sputtered, but kept burning, and he was glad to see that the shelter hadn't flooded. The horses and mules and the wild-eyed cow were all standing on damp straw, but not hock-deep in mud. The privy door creaked, and he saw Rachel's slender, dark shape emerge. She saw the torch and came to join him, drawing her shawl about her against the rain. "Are the beasts all right?" Raindrops sparkled in her damp hair, and he smiled at her.
"I expect their supper was better than ours."
She shuddered in recollection.
"I would much prefer to have eaten hay. Did thee see what was in—"
"No," he interrupted, "and I shall be much happier if you don't tell me."
She snorted, but desisted. He had no desire to go back into the fetid house at once, and Rachel seemed similarly disinclined, moving to scratch her mule's drooping ears.
"I do not like the way that woman looks at us," Rachel said after a moment, not looking at him. "She keeps staring at my shoes, and so she wonders whether they would fit her."
William glanced at Rachel's feet himself. Her shoes were not in any way fashionable, but were sturdy and well-made, though also well-worn and smeared with dried mud. Rachel glanced uneasily at the house.
"I will be pleased to leave here, even if it should still be raining in the morning."
"We'll leave," he assured her, "without waiting for breakfast, if you prefer."
He leaned against one of the upright poles that supported the shelter, feeling the mist of rain cool on his neck. The drowsiness had left him, though the tiredness had not, and he realized that he shared her sense of unease. Mr. Johnson seemed amiable, if uncouth, but there was something almost too eager in his manner. He leaned forward avidly in conversation, eyes agleam, and his dirty hands were restless on his knees. It might be only the natural loneliness of a man who lacked company, for surely the presence of the sullen Mrs. Johnson would be little consolation. But William's father had taught him to pay attention to his instincts, and he therefore didn't try to argue himself out of them. Without comment or apology, he rummaged in the saddlebag hanging from the post and found the small dagger that he carried in his boot while riding. Rachel's eyes followed it as he tucked it into the waist of his breeches and pulled his shirt loose to cover it. Her chin was puckered, but she didn't protest. The torch was beginning to gutter, almost burned out. He held out his arm, and Rachel took it without protest, drawing close to him. He wanted to put his arm around her, but contented himself with drawing in his elbow, finding the distant warmth of her body a comfort. The bulk of the farmhouse was darker than the night, lacking either door or window at the back. They circled it in silence, rain thumping on their skulls, feet squelching on the sodden ground. Only a flicker of light showed through the shutters, the faintest indication of human tenancy. He heard Rachel swallow and touched her hand lightly as he opened the door for her.
"Sleep well," he whispered to her. "The dawn will come before you know it."
It was the stew that saved his life. He slept almost at once, overcome by weariness, but found his sleep troubled by obnoxious dreams. He was walking down a hallway with a figured Turkey carpet, but realized after a time that what he had taken for twining patterns in the rug were, in fact, snakes, which raised their heads, swaying at his approach. The snakes were slow-moving, and he was able to skip over them, but lurched from side to side as a result, hitting the walls of the corridor, which seemed to be closing in upon him, narrowing the way. Then he was enclosed so tightly that he must proceed sideways, the wall behind him scraping his back, the plaster surface before him so close that he couldn't bend his head to look down. He was worried about the snakes in the carpet, but couldn't see them, and kicked out to the side with his feet, now and then hitting something heavy. Panicked, he felt one twine about his leg, then glide upward, wrapping round his body and burrowing its head through the front of his shirt, prodding him hard and painfully in the abdomen, looking for somewhere to bite. He woke suddenly, panting and sweating, aware that the pain in his guts was real. It bit with a sharp cramp, and he pulled up his legs and rolled onto his side an instant before the axe struck the floorboards where his head had just been. He let out a tremendous fart and rolled in blind panic toward the dark figure struggling to free the axe from the wood. He struck Johnson's legs, grabbed them, and yanked. The man fell on him with a curse and grabbed him by the throat. William punched and thrashed at his opponent, but the hands on his throat clung like grim death, and his vision darkened and flashed with coloured lights. There was screaming going on somewhere nearby. More by instinct than plan, William suddenly lunged forward, striking Johnson in the face with his forehead. It hurt, but the death grip on his throat relaxed, and he wrenched loose and rolled over, scrambling to his feet. The fire had died to embers, and there was no more than a faint glow of light in the room. A heaving mass of bodies in the corner was the source of the screaming, but nothing he could do about that. Johnson had kicked the axe loose. William saw the dull gleam of its blade in the split second before Johnson seized it and swung it at his head. He ducked, rushed in, and managed to grab Johnson's wrist, pulling hard. The cheek of the falling axe blade struck his knee a paralyzing blow, and he crumpled, pulling Johnson down with him, but got the other knee up in time to keep from being flattened beneath the other man's body. He jerked to the side, felt sudden heat at his back and the ping of sparks. They had rolled onto the edge of the hearth. He reached back and seized the handful of hot embers which he ground into Johnson's face, ignoring the searing pain in his palm. Johnson fell back, clutching his face and making short, "ah, ah," noises, as though he had not the breath to scream. The axe was dangling from one hand. He sensed William rise and swung it blindly, one-handed. William grabbed the axe handle, jerked it from Johnson's grasp, took a good two-handed hold upon the throat of the handle, and brought the bit down on Johnson's head with a chunk like a kicked pumpkin. The impact vibrated through his hands and arms. He let go and stumbled backward. His mouth was full of bile. Saliva overflowed and he wiped a sleeve across his mouth. He was breathing like a bellows but couldn't seem to get any air in his lungs. Johnson reeled toward him, arms outstretched, the axe sticking in his head. The handle quivered, turning to and fro like an insect's feeler. Slowly, horribly, Johnson's hands reached up to take hold of it. William wanted to scream but didn't have the breath for it. Backing away in panic, he brushed a hand against his breeches and felt wetness there. He glanced down, fearing the worst, but saw instead the cloth dark with blood, and at the same time realized that there was a slight stinging sensation at the top of his thigh.
"Bloody hell," he muttered, fumbling at his waist.
He'd managed to stab himself with his own dagger, but it was still there, thank God. The feel of the hilt steadied him, and he pulled it out, still backing away as Johnson came toward him, making a sort of yowling noise, yanking at the axe handle. The axe came loose, releasing a gush of blood that rolled down Johnson's face and spattered William's face and arms and chest. Johnson swung the axe with a huff of effort, but his movements were slow and clumsy. William ducked aside, farting with the movement, but regaining his nerve. He tightened his grip on the dagger and looked for a place to stick it. Round the back, his mind suggested. Johnson was dashing one forearm uselessly across his face, trying to clear his eyes, the axe held in the other hand, sweeping to and fro in wide, trembling swathes.
"William!"
Surprised by the voice, he glanced aside and was nearly struck by the wavering blade.
"Shut up," he said crossly. "I'm busy." "Yes, I see that," said Denny Hunter. "Let me help thee."
He was white-faced and shaking nearly as much as Johnson, but stepped forward and, with a sudden lunge, seized the axe handle and pulled the implement out of Johnson's grasp. He stepped back and dropped it on the floor with a thunk, looking as though he might be sick at any moment.
"Thank you," said William.
He stepped forward and drove the dagger upward under Johnson's ribs into his heart. Johnson's eyes opened wide with the shock and stared directly into William's. They were grey-blue, with a scattering of gold and yellow flecks near the dark iris. William had never seen anything more beautiful and stood transfixed for an instant, until the feel of pumping blood over his hand returned him to himself. He jerked the knife free and stood back, letting the body fall. He was trembling all over and about to shit himself. He turned blindly and headed for the door, brushing past Denny, who said something that he didn't quite hear. Shuddering and gasping in the privy, though, he thought the doctor had said, "They did not have to do that."
"Yes," he thought, "I did."
And bowed his head upon his knees, waiting for everything to abate. William emerged at last from the privy, feeling clammy and rubber-limbed, but less internally volatile. Denny Hunter rushed past him and into the structure, from which explosive noises and loud groans were immediately heard. Moving hastily away, he made his way through a spatter of rain toward the house. Dawn was some way off, but the air had begun to stir, and the farmhouse stood out against the paling sky, black and skeletal. He entered, feeling very uncertain, to find Rachel, white as a bone, standing guard with a broom over Mrs. Johnson, who was wrapped tightly in a filthy sheet, thrashing a bit, and making peculiar hissing and spitting noises. Her husband's remains lay face down by the hearth in a pool of congealing blood. He didn't want to look at the body, but felt it would be somehow wrong not to, and went up and stood by it for a moment, looking down. One of the hunters had poked up the fire and added wood. There was warmth in the room, but he couldn't feel it.
"He's dead," Rachel said, her voice colourless.
"Yes."
He didn't know how he was meant to feel in such a situation, and had no real idea of how he did feel. He turned away, though, with a slight sense of relief, and came to look at the prisoner.
"Did she?"
"She tried to cut Denny's throat, but she stepped on my hand and woke me. I saw the knife and screamed, and he seized her and..." She pulled a hand through her hair, and he saw that she had lost her cap, and the hair was loose and tangled. "I sat on her," she said, "and Denny rolled her up in the sheet. I don't think she can speak," Rachel added as he stooped to look at the woman. "Her tongue is split."
Mrs. Johnson, hearing this, thrust out her tongue in vindictive fashion and waggled the two halves of it independently at him. With the memory of the dream snakes vivid in his mind, he flinched in instinctive revulsion, but saw the look of satisfaction that crossed her face.
"If she can do that with her nasty tongue, she can talk," he said,
and reaching down, took hold of the woman's scrawny throat.
"Tell me why I shouldn't kill you too." "It's not my fault," she said promptly, in such a rasping hiss that he nearly let go of her in shock. "He makes me help him."
William glanced over his shoulder at the body on the hearth.
"Not any more."
He tightened his grip, feeling the beat of her pulse against his thumb.
"How many travellers have you killed, the two of you?"
She didn't answer, but stroked her upper lip lasciviously with her tongue, first one half and then the other. He let go her throat and slapped her hard across the face. Rachel gasped.
"Thee must not."
"Oh, yes, I must."
He rubbed his hand against the side of his breeches, trying to get rid of the feel of the woman's sweat, her slack skin, her bony throat. His other hand was beginning to throb painfully.
He wanted suddenly to pick up the axe and smash her with it over and over, crush her head, hack her to bits. His body trembled with the urge. She saw it in his eyes and stared back at him, eyes black and glittering.
"You don't want me to kill her?" he asked Rachel.
"Thee must not," she whispered. Very slowly she reached for his burned hand, and when he didn't pull away, took it into hers. There was a roaring in his ears, and he felt dizzy. "Thee is hurt," she said softly. "Come outside. I will wash it." She led him out, half blind and stumbling, and made him sit on the chopping block while she brought a bucket of water from the trough. It had stopped raining, though the world dripped, and the dawn air was moist and fresh in his chest. Rachel bathed his hand in the cold water, and the burning eased a little. She touched his thigh where the blood had dried in a long patch down his breeches, but let it go when he shook his head. "I'll bring thee whiskey. There is some in Denny's bag." She stood up, but he grabbed her wrist with his good hand, holding hard. "Rachel." His own voice sounded odd to him, remote, as though someone else was speaking.
"I've never killed anyone before. I don't quite know what to do about it."
He looked up at her, searching her face for understanding.
"If it had been, I expected it to be in battle. That, I think I'd know how. How to feel, I mean. If it had been like that."
She met his eyes, her face drawn in troubled thought. The light touched her, a pink softer than the sheen of pearls, and after a long time she touched his face very gently. "No," she said. "Thee wouldn't."